It's odd when you see the echo of the son in the father. There's no doubt he's Hank's father, but in a bizarre world way. Yes, he's obviously older, but he's also better dressed, shaved, groomed. Hank's hair sticks up as though it's a science experiment gone wrong. His father is perfectly coiffed, the gray slicked down and parted by a divine entity. As we open our car doors, Tom Stroud is wringing his hands. He rocks back and forth. His eyes are a little too open. I glance at Augie. He sees it, too. This is a man expecting bad news, the worst sort of news. We've both delivered news of that sort, and of course, we've both been on the receiving end. Tom Stroud takes a shaky step forward. Augie?
We don't know where Hank is, Augie says. That's why we're here.
Relief floods his face. His son is not dead. Tom Stroud ignores me and heads toward Augie. He opens his arms and embraces his old friend. Augie hesitates for a second, almost recoiling in pain, before relaxing and hugging him back.
It's good to see you, Augie, Tom Stroud says.
Same, Tom.
When they let go, Augie asks,
Do you know where Hank is?
Tom Stroud shakes his head and says, Why don't you come inside? Tom Stroud makes us coffee with a French press. Doris liked to use one of those K-cup machines, but I think the coffee ends up tasting like plastic. He hands me a cup, then Augie. I take a sip. It's excellent, by the way, or maybe it's my Francophile bias popping up again. Augie and I sit on stools in the small kitchen. Tom Stroud stays standing. He looks out a window that faces a building that looks exactly like this one. Doris and I got divorced when Hank was 10. The two of us, Doris and me, we started dating when we were 15. That's too young. We got married when we were still in college. I ended up working for my dad. He manufactured pallet nails and staples. I was third generation. The factory was in Newark when I was a kid, until the riots. Then we moved it overseas. My job. It was the most boring job in the world. At least, that's what I thought at the time. I look at Augie. I expect an eye roll, but Augie is either faking paying attention to keep the guy talking, or he's genuinely moved by his old friend's story. Anyway, I'm in my 30s. I hate my job. We're not doing well financially. I'm getting old before my time, and I'm miserable, and it's all my fault. The divorce, I mean. You reach an edge, and then you step off, and you just keep tumbling down. Doris and I fought. We started to hate each other. Hank, my ungrateful son, started to hate me too, so, you know, the hell with them, right? I moved far away, started a fish and tackle business with a gun range in the back. I tried to come back a few times, visit Hank, but he was just sullen when I came around, a pain in the ass, so why bother, you know? I got married again, but it didn't last. She left me. No kids this time, no big deal. Neither of us ever really thought it was forever. His voice drifts off.
Tom?
Yeah, Augie?
Why did you come back?
I'm out there in Cheyenne. I'm living my life, doing my thing. Then Doris calls and tells me she has cancer. There are tears in his eyes now. I look at Augie. He's close to welling up, too. I catch the next flight back here. Doris and me, we don't fight when I get back. We don't talk about the past. We don't rehash what happened or even ask why I'm back. I just move back in. I know that makes no sense.
It makes sense,
Augie says. Tom shakes his head. So much waste. A lifetime of it. No one says anything for a moment. I want to move on, but this is Augie's play now. We had 6 healthy months, and then 6 not-so-healthy months. I don't call them good or bad months. They're all good if you're doing the right thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Augie says. I know what you mean. I made sure Hank was here when Doris died. We were both with her. Augie adjusts himself on the stool. I stay very still. Tom Stroud finally turns away from the window. I should have called you, Augie. Augie shrugs it off. I wanted to. I really did. I was going to call, but...
No need to explain, Tom.
Augie clears his throat.
Does Hank ever come by?
Yeah, sometimes. I've been thinking about selling this place, putting the money in a trust for him. But I think the condo gives Hank some semblance of stability. I try to get him help. Sometimes he's fine. Which makes it almost worse, like he gets a glimpse of what his life could be, and then it's snatched away. Tom Stroud looks toward me for the first time. You went to school with Hank?
I did, yes.
Then, maybe you know this already, Hank is ill. I give him a small nod. People don't get it's an illness. They expect Hank to behave a certain way, to get over it, or snap out of it or something, but... It's like asking a man with two broken legs to sprint across a field. He can't.
When was the last time you saw Hank, I ask.
It's been a few weeks, but it's not like his visits are consistent.
So you weren't worried?
Tom Stroud hems on that one. I was and I wasn't.
Meaning?
Meaning if I was, I didn't really know what I could do about it. Hank's an adult. He's not committed. If I'd called you guys, what would you have done?
There is no need to answer. It's obvious.
Did Hank show you the video someone took of him in the park, I ask?
What video?
I take out my mobile phone and play it for him. When it is over, Tom puts his hand to his face.
My God.
Who posted that?
We don't know.
Can I issue a missing persons report for Hank or something?
You can, I say.
Then let's do that. Augie?
Augie looks up at him.
Find my boy, okay?
Augie gives a slow nod.
We'll do our best.
Before we leave, Tom Stroud leads us to a room his ex-wife set aside for Hank.
He never stays here. I don't think Hank's been inside this room since I've been back.
When he opens the door, you can smell the stale. We step in and see the far wall, and I just turn to look for Augie's reaction. The wall is blanketed with black and white photos, newspaper clippings, and aerial shots of the Nike missile base in its prime. The material is mostly old, the photos rolling in on the corners, the clippings yellowing like tobacco-stained teeth. I scan for something recent or maybe something that I couldn't just find routinely online, but I don't see anything special. Tom notices us staring. Yeah, I guess Hank was pretty obsessed with that old base. Again I glance at Augie. Again Augie is having none of it. Did Hank ever say anything about it to you, I ask?
Like what?
I shrug. Like anything.
Nothing that made sense.
How about stuff that didn't make sense? Tom Stroud looks over at Augie.
You think this base has something?
No, Augie says. Tom turns back to me. Hank just ranted about it. You know the kind of crazy stuff? They were keeping secrets, there were evil men, they were doing mind experiments. A sad smile comes to his face.
Funny.
What? I say.
Well, not funny but ironic. Like I said, Hank was really obsessed with the place, even as a kid.
He hesitates here. Augie and I say nothing.
Anyway, Doris used to joke that maybe Hank was right. Maybe some secret lab did do weird experiments at the base. Maybe one night when Hank was a little kid, he walked up that path and the bad guys grabbed him and did something to his brain, and that's why he's like he is now.
The room is silent.
Tom tries to laugh it off.
Doris was only joking,
Tom says.
Gallows humor. Something like this happens to your kid, you grasp at any straw. You know? Chapter 14. Principal Deborah Kieran is pregnant. I know it may not be good form to notice a pregnancy, but she is a tiny woman everywhere, except the belly, and she's dressed in orange, which is a curious choice unless she is intentionally embracing the pumpkin look. She steadies herself on the sides of the chair. It takes a bit of effort for her to rise. I tell her there is no need, but she's already past the halfway point, and it looks like it might take a crane and crew to stop her momentum and safely lower her back into the chair. "I'm in the 8th month, Karen says. I tell you that because everybody's suddenly afraid if you ask, "Are you pregnant?" they'll be wrong and get in trouble or something. "Wait," I say. "You're pregnant?" Kieran gives a side smile. "No, I swallowed a bowling ball." "I was going to say a beach ball." "You're an amusing guy, Nap." "This your first kid?" "It is." "That's wonderful. Congrats." "Thanks." She moves toward me. "You done charming me with small talk?"
"How did I do?"
"So charming that if I wasn't already pregnant, I would be now. So what can I do for you, Nap?"
"We don't know each other super well, but we both live in Westbridge, and when you're a local principal and a local cop, you bump into each other at the too many town gatherings." She starts waddling down the corridor. I walk with her, trying not to subconsciously copy her. The corridors are an empty, only a school corridor during classes can be. The place hasn't changed much since we were here, Leo. Hard tiled floors, lockers lining both sides. The wall above them painted a Ticonderoga pencil yellow. The biggest change, which isn't a change, is perspective. They say that schools seem smaller as you age. That's true. I think maybe it's that perspective that keeps the old ghosts at bay. "It's about Hank Stroud," I say to her.
"Interesting."
"Why do you say that?"
"As I'm sure you're aware, the parents complain about him all the time."
I nod.
"But I haven't seen him in weeks. I think that viral video scared him off."
"You know about the video?"
"I try to know what's going on in my school."
She peeks through a small rectangular window into a classroom, moves to the next door, peeks in again.
"But I mean, come on, half the country knows about that."
"Have you ever seen Hank expose himself?"
"If I had, don't you think I would have called you guys?"
"So that's a no."
"That's a no." "You think he did it?" I ask. "Exposed himself?"
"Yes."
We keep walking.
She checks out another classroom. Someone in the room must catch her eye because she waves.
"I'm of two minds on Hank."
A student turns the corner, sees us, stops in her tracks. Principal Kieran says,
"Where are you going, Kathy?"
Kathy looks everywhere but at us.
"To see you."
"Okay, wait in my office. I'll be there in a few minutes." Kathy does that scared servant shuffle past us. I look at Kieran, but it's not my business. She's already back on the move.
"You are of two minds on Hank,"
I say, to prompt us back on subject.
"Those are public grounds out there," she says. "Open to the public, that's the law. Hank's got as much right to be on them as anyone. We have joggers run past there every day, too. Kimmy Konisberg jogs by. You've noticed her, right?"
Kimmy Konisberg is, for lack of more adequate terminology, the town MILF. She has it, and boy, does she flaunt it.
Who?
Right. So every morning, Kimmy jogs by in the tightest and yet least supportive lycra imaginable. If I was a certain type of person, I would say she wants these adolescent boys to stare.
Would that type of person be truthful?
Touché.
And this town is such a hypocritical protective bubble as it is, and I get that. I get that's why people move out here to raise their families, to keep them safe.
Heck! She rests her hand on her belly.
I want my kids safe, too. But it can become too sheltered. That's not healthy.
I grew up in Brooklyn. I'm not going to tell you how rough I had it. We walked past 6 Hanks every day, so maybe our kids can learn compassion. Hank is a human being, not something to be scorned. A few months back, the kids found out Hank went to school here, so one of the kids, you know Corey Mistison? I know the family, good people.
Right. Been in town a long time. Anyway, Corey dug up an old middle school yearbook from Hank's last year.
She stops and turns to me. You and Hank were here at the same time, right?
Right.
So you know.
The kids were shocked. Hank used to be just like them, in chorus, won the science fair, was even treasurer of the class. It got the kids thinking. There but for the grace of God. Exactly. She takes two more steps. Oh, God, I'm hungry all the time. And then when I eat, I feel sick. This eighth month just sucks. I'm hating all men right now, by the way.
I'll keep that in mind.
And then I say, you said two minds. Pardon?
With Hank, you said you have two minds. So what's mind two?
Oh. She starts up again, her belly leading the way. Look, I hate the stigma attached to mental illness. That goes without saying. But I don't like Hank hanging around here either. I don't think he's a danger, but I don't know that he's not either. I worry I'll be so politically correct about it that I'm not protecting my students. Do you know what I mean?
I let her know that I do.
So, I don't like Hank standing out there. But so what? I don't like that Mike Inge's mom always illegally drops him off in the no-drop-off zone. I don't like that Lisa Vance's dad clearly helps her with her art projects. I don't like that Andrew McDade's parents storm in whenever the report cards arrive to grade grub for their kid. I don't like a lot of things. She stops and puts a hand on my arm. But do you know what I don't like most? I look at her. Online shaming. It's the worst sort of vigilante justice. Hank is just the most recent example. Last year, someone tweets a picture of a kid with a caption saying, "This punk stole my iPhone but forgot all the pics he takes are on my cloud. Please retweet to find him." The purported punk was Evan Ober, a student here. You know him?
Name doesn't ring a bell. No reason it should. Evan's a good kid. Did he steal the iPhone?
No, of course not. That's my point. He started dating Carrie Mills. Carrie's ex, Danny Turner, was furious about it.
So Turner posted that pic.
Yep. But I can't prove it. That's the shitbird anonymity of online shaming. Did you see that girl who just walked past us?
The one you sent to your office?
Yeah. That's Kathy Garrett. She's a sixth grade girl. Sixth grade, Nap. So a few weeks ago, Kathy accidentally left her phone in the bathroom. Another girl found it. So this other girl takes the phone, snaps a close-up of her, privates, and then sends the pic to Kathy's entire contact list, including her parents, her grandparents, everyone. I make a face. Ugh, that's sick. I know, right? She grimaces and puts both hands on her lower back. You okay? I'm 8 months pregnant, remember?
Right.
I feel like I got a school bus parked on my bladder. Did you ever catch the girl who took the pics?
Nope.
We have 5 or 6 suspects, all 12-year-old girls. But the only way to know for certain... I hold up my hand. Say no more. Kathy's been so traumatized by the whole thing, she pretty much visits my office every day. We talk, she calms down. She heads back to class. Kieran stops and looks back over her shoulder. I should get to Kathy now. We start walking back. Your talk about the anonymity of online shaming, I say. Is this your way of telling me you don't believe Hank exposed himself?
No, but you're making my point for me.
What's that?
I don't know because I can't know.
That's always the problem with this sort of innuendo. You want to just dismiss it, but sometimes you can't. Maybe Hank did, maybe he didn't. I can't unring that bell, and sorry, that's wrong.
You've watched the video of Hank, right?
Right. Any idea who filmed it?
Again, I have no proof.
I don't need proof. I wouldn't want to cast aspersions without evidence, Nap. That's what the online shaming does. We reach her office. She looks at me. I look at her. Then she lets loose a long sigh. But I can tell you that there is an eighth grade girl named Maria Hansen. My secretary can give you her address. Her mother, Suzanne, has come to see me frequently to complain about Hank. When I tell her that there is nothing that legally can be done, she becomes particularly agitated. Principal Kieran looks through the glass at Kathy. Her eyes start to water. I better get to her, she says.
Okay.
Damn. She wipes the tears from her eyes with her fingers and looks at me. All dry?
Yeah.
Eighth month, she says. My hormones are on crack. I nod.
You having a girl?
She smiles at me.
How did you guess?
She waddles away.
I watch her through the glass as she takes Kathy in her arms and lets the young girl sob on her shoulder. Then I leave to find Suzanne Hansen. Chapter 15. Westbridge doesn't have a poor side of town. It has a poor acre, maybe. There's a grouping of aging three-family houses located between a Ford dealership and a Dick's Sporting Goods near the town center. Maura and her mom moved in here the summer before our junior year. They sublet two rooms from a Vietnamese family after Maura's father cleaned them out and ran off. Maura's mom worked a few part-time jobs and drank too much. The Hansen family lives on the first floor of a rust-brick edifice. The wood stoop groans as I step up. When I ring the bell, a big man in mechanic's overalls comes to the door. The name Joe is stenciled on the right chest pocket. Joe does not look happy to see me. "Who are you?" Joe asks. I show him my badge. A woman I assume is Suzanne Hansen comes into view from behind him. When she sees my badge, too, her eyes widen, probably in parental worry. I reassure them right away. "Everything is fine," I say. Joe remains suspicious. He steps in front of his wife and gives me narrow eyes.
"What do you want?"
I pocket my badge. Several concerned citizens have filed complaints against a man named Hank Stroud. I'm looking into them.
"See, Joe?"
the woman I assume is Suzanne says. She slides in front of her husband and pushes open the door.
"Come in, officer."
We move through the front room into the kitchen. She offers me a seat at the table. I take it. The floor is formica. The table is round and faux wood. The chair is chipped white Windsor. There's a clock above the door that uses red dice for numbers. The inscription on top reads, "Fabulous Las Vegas." Toast crumbs litter the table. Suzanne sweeps them with one hand over the table's side into her free palm. Then she dumps the crumbs into the sink and runs the water. I take out a pad and pen for show. "Do you know who Hank Stroud is?" Suzanne sits across from me. Joe stands over her, his hand on her shoulder, still eyeing me like I'm here to either shoplift or bed his wife.
"He's that horrible pervert who hangs around the school," she says.
"I assume you've seen him more than once," I say.
"Almost every day. He ogles all the girls, including my daughter Maria. She's only 14.
I nod, trying on a friendly smile.
"You've seen this personally?"
"Oh, sure. It's terrible. And, by the way, it's about time the police got on this. You work hard, you scrape together enough money to move to a beautiful town like Westbridge. I mean, you expect your kids to be safe, right?"
"Definitely," I say.
"Then what do you have, some hobo?" "Do people still say hobo?"
I smile and spread my hands. "Why not?"
"Right, hobo. He hangs around our children. You move to a town like this, and every day you have to see this bum." "That's what he is. I know you shouldn't use the word. This bum every day lurking around your children. It's like this giant, awful weed in a beautiful flower garden, you know?"
I nod. "We need to pull the weed out."
"Exactly."
I take some pretend notes. "Have you ever seen Mr. Stroud do more than ogle?" She's about to blurt something out, but now I notice the hand on her shoulder gently squeezed to silence her. I look up at Joe. He looks back at me. He gets why I'm here. I get that he gets it, and he gets that I get that. Shorter. The game is over. Or is just beginning. "You posted a video of Hank Stroud, didn't you, Mrs. Hansen?" Her eyes are aflame. She shakes Joe's hand off her shoulder.
"You don't know that."
"Oh, I know it," I say. "We already ran a voice analysis. We also traced down the internet IP address from which the video originated." I give what I said a second to land. "They both confirm that you, Mrs. Hansen, filmed and posted that video." "This is a lie, of course. I ran no voice analysis or internet trace."
"And what if she did?" Joe asks.
"Not saying she did or she didn't, but if she did, there's no law against it, is there?"
"I don't care," I say. "I'm here to find out what happened, that's all." I look her straight in the eyes. She looks down a second, then back up at me. "You filmed Hank. If you keep denying it, you're just going to piss me off. So tell me what you saw."
He pulled down his pants, she says.
"When?"
"You mean like the date?"
For starters, sure.
It was maybe a month ago.
Before school, after school, when?
Before school, that's when I see him. I drop my daughter off at 7:45 a.m., then I stay and watch her walk all the way in every day because, well, wouldn't you? You drop your 14-year-old daughter off at this beautiful school and there's a creepy pervert right across the way. I don't understand why the police don't do something.
Tell me exactly what happened.
I told you. He pulled down his pants.
Your daughter was walking, and he pulled down his pants.
Yes.
On your videos, pants are up.
He pulled them back up.
I see. So he pulled his pants down, and then he pulled them back up.
Yes.
She's looking up to the left. I forget if that means a lie is coming or a memory. Doesn't matter. I don't believe much in that stuff.
He saw me fiddling with my phone, and he panicked, and so he pulled them back up.
How long would you say his pants were down?
I don't know. How could I know?
Joe adds, you think she was carrying a stopwatch or something?
It was long enough, that I can tell you.
I bite back the obvious joke and say, go on.
Suzanne looks confused. What do you mean, go on?
He pulled his pants down, he pulled his pants up. I look very unimpressed. That's it? Joe doesn't like that.
What, that's not enough for you?
How do you know his pants didn't just fall down, I ask. Once again, Suzanne's eyes drop to the table before lifting toward me. I know a lie is coming. I am not disappointed.
He pulls his pants down, she says again. Then he yells at my daughter to look at his... I mean, he starts stroking it and everything.
Ah, human nature. So predictable sometimes. I see this a lot, Leo. You hear a witness tell you something that they hope will shock your senses. Then I, as an investigator, act blasé. The truthful person lets it go, but the liar starts embellishing, trying to up the story, so I share their outrage. I use the word embellishing here, but really it's straight-up lying. They can't help themselves. I know now, and don't want to waste much more time here. Time to cut it. Watch and learn, Leo. You're lying, I say. Suzanne's mouth turns into a shocked, perfect O. Joe's face reddens. Are you calling my wife a liar? What part of your lying left that in doubt, Joe? If Suzanne had been wearing pearls, she'd have clutched them.
How dare you?
I smile now. I know it's a lie, I say, because I just talked to Maria. The anger rises.
You did what?
Suzanne shouts. It took a while for your daughter to cave, I say, but eventually Maria admitted to me it never happened. They are both apoplectic. I try not to enjoy this.
You aren't allowed to do that!
Do what?
You can't talk to our daughter without our permission, she says. I'll have your badge!
I frown. Why does everyone say that?
What?
That threat, I'll have your badge. You saw it on TV, right? Joe takes a step toward me.
I don't like the way you're talking to my wife.
And I don't care. Sit down, Joe. He sneers at me.
Tough guy. Because you have a badge.
Again with the badge. I sigh, take out the badge, slide it across the table. Here, you want it? Take it. I stand and get right in Joe's face. You ready to go now? Joe takes a step back. I step closer to him. He tries to look me in the eyes, but he can't hold it.
Not worth it, he mutters.
What did you say? Joe doesn't reply. He circles the table and sits in the chair next to his wife. I glare down at Suzanne Hansen. If you don't tell me the truth, I'm going to launch a full investigation and charge you with 2 counts of violating Federal Internet Act Section 418, which upon conviction could lead to a penalty of $100,000 and up to 4 years in prison. I'm making this up. I don't think there is any Federal Internet Act. The specific section number is a nice touch, don't you think?
That bum shouldn't be there, she insists. You people wouldn't do anything about it.
So you did, I say.
He shouldn't be allowed to be that close to a school.
He has a name. It's Hank Stroud, and he's missing.
What?
Since you posted your video, no one has seen him.
Good,
she says. How's that?
Maybe the video scared him.
And you feel good about that, do you? Suzanne opens her mouth and closes it again.
I was just trying to protect my child. To protect all the children at the school, really.
You better tell me everything.
She did. Suzanne admitted that she exaggerated to the point of making it all up. Hank never exposed himself. Tired and frustrated by what she perceived as the lack of action by school administrators and law enforcement, Suzanne Hansen did what she thought best. It's only a question of time before he did something awful. I was just trying to prevent that. Noble, I reply with as much disdain as I can muster. Suzanne was cleaning up the filth by trying to twist the reality of her town into the idyllic haven she believed it should be. Hank was mere refuse. Best to dump him curbside, where he could be trucked out of sight and smell. I would lecture Suzanne Hansen on her lack of empathy, but what's the point? I remember once when we were maybe 10, driving through a rough neighborhood in Newark. Parents always tell their kids to look out the windows and be grateful for what they've got. But our dad handled it differently. He just said one line that has always stuck with me. Every person has hopes and dreams. It is something I try to remember every time I cross a fellow human being. Does that include low-life turds like Trey? Of course. He has hopes and dreams, too. That's fine. But when your hopes and dreams crush the hopes and dreams of others... I'm rationalizing again. I don't care about the Treys of the world, simple as that. Maybe I should. But I don't. Or maybe I doth protest too much. What do you think, Leo? When I finally leave their stuffy house, when Joe slams the door behind me to make some kind of stand, to himself at least, I take a deep breath. I glance over to where Maura used to live. She never brought me here, and I was inside only once. This was about 2 weeks after you and Diana were killed. I turn now and look at the tree across the street. That was where I waited, hidden. First I saw the Vietnamese family exit. 15 minutes later, Maura's mom stumbled out in an ill-fitted summer dress. She managed to weave her way down the street toward the bus stop. When she was out of sight, I broke into the house. The answer to why is probably obvious. I was looking for clues to where Maura might have gone. When I had cornered her mother earlier, she said something about her transferring to a private school. I asked where. She wouldn't tell me. It's over, Nap, Mrs. Wells told me, her breath stinking of booze. Maura has moved on. So should you. But I didn't believe her. So I broke in. I rummaged through all the drawers and cabinets. I went into Maura's room. Her clothes and backpack were still there. Did she pack anything? It didn't look like it. I also searched for my varsity jacket. For all Maura's eye-rolling about my being a jock and the stupid intensity of sports in this town and the anti-hip, quasi-sexist idea of it all, Maura got a kick out of wearing my varsity jacket. Retro, maybe. Ironic? I don't know. Or maybe it wasn't a contradiction at all. Maura was an old soul. So I searched for my varsity jacket, the green one with the white sleeves and the crossed hockey sticks on the back, and my name and captain stenciled on the front. But I couldn't find it. Did Maura take the jacket with her? I always wondered. Why wasn't the jacket in her room? I turn away from the house now and look out into the distance. I have a few minutes. I know where I want to go. I cross the road and find the railroad tracks. I know you are not supposed to walk beside them, but I'm living on the edge today. I follow the tracks out of the town center, up past Downing Road and Coddington Terrace, past the storage facility and the old industrial plant that's been converted into a party space and circuit training studio. I'm away from civilization now, high up on that hill between the station for Westbridge and the one for Castleton. I skirt past broken beer bottles and reach the edge. I look down and see the steeple from Westbridge Presbyterian. It lights up at 7 p.m., so I assume you saw it that night. Or were you too stoned or high to take notice? I knew that you were starting to get a little too fond of recreational drugs and drinking. In hindsight, I guess I should have stopped it, but at the time it didn't hit me as a big deal. Everyone was doing it. You, Maura, most of our friends. And the only reason I didn't partake was because of my training. I take another deep breath. So how did it all go down, Leo? Why were you here, on the other side of Westbridge, and not hanging out in the woods near the old Nike base?
Did you and Diana want to be alone? Were you trying to avoid your conspiracy club friends? Were you intentionally staying away from the old base? Why were you here? Why were you on these train tracks?
I wait for you to say something.
You don't.
I wait a little more because I know it won't be long now. The main line runs every hour this time of day. I wait until I hear the whistle as it pulls out of the Westbridge station. Not far away now. Part of me wants to stand on the tracks. No, I don't want to end it. I'm not suicidal. But I want to know what it was like for you. I want to reconstruct that night so I know exactly what you experienced. I watch now as the train hurtles over the horizon. The tracks vibrate to the point where I can't believe they don't come apart. Did you feel that vibration under your feet? Did Diana? Were you standing off to the side, just as I am? Did you both look down at the steeple, turn, and then decide to jump across at the last possible second? I can see the train now. I watch it come closer. Did you see it that night, hear it, feel it? You must have. It bears down on these tracks with unfathomable power. I take another step back. When it rushes by, I'm a full 10 yards away from the train, and yet I'm forced to close my eyes and raise my hand to protect my face. The swoosh of air nearly knocks me off my feet. The pure might of the locomotive, the sheer mass times velocity, is awesome, devastating, unstoppable. A mind, like a heart, goes where it wants. So I imagine that hard steel front grille crushing human flesh. I imagine those churning wheels grinding bone into dust. I pry my eyes open and squint at the train speeding by. It seems to take forever, but the train is endless, crushing and churning and grinding. I stare straight at it, letting it blur without trying to focus. My eyes water. I've seen the horrific, splatter-filled crime scene photos from that night, but they oddly don't move me. The destruction was so great, the disfigurement so immense, that either I can't link the misshapen, waxy chunks to you and Diana, or, more likely, my mind won't let me. When the train finally passes, when the quiet slowly returns, my eyes start to take in the scene. Even now, all these years later, I'm searching for clues, evidence, something that may have been missed. Being up here is strange. The horror is obvious, but it also feels somehow holy, somehow right to be in the place where you drew your final breath. As I start back down the hill, I check my phone for messages. Nothing from our old classmate Beth Fletcher, nay Lashley, M.D. I call her office in Ann Arbor again. The receptionist gives me a bit of the runaround, so I get more pointed. Soon a woman who introduces herself as Cassie and calls herself the office manager gets on the line. Dr. Fletcher is unavailable at this time. Cassie? I'm tired of being jerked around. I'm a cop. I need to speak to her. I can only pass that message on to her. Where is she? I wouldn't know. Wait. You don't know where she is? It's not my concern. I have your name and number. Is there any other message you'd like me to give her? In for a penny, in for a pound. Do you have a pen, Cassie? I do. Tell Dr. Fletcher that our friend Rex Canton has been murdered. Tell her Hank Stroud is missing. Tell her Maura Wells briefly resurfaced and then went missing again. Tell the good doctor that it all goes back to the conspiracy club. Tell her to call me. Silence. Then, is that Laura with an L or Maura with an M? Completely unflustered. Maura with an M. I'll give Dr. Fletcher the message. She hangs up. I don't like this. Maybe I'll call the Ann Arbor Police Department. Ask them to send one of their people over to Beth's home and office. I keep walking. I think again about all the strands, your and Diana's accident, Rex's murder and Maura being at the scene, Hank and that viral video, the conspiracy club. I try to find connections, draw lines, work Venn diagrams of these events in my head, but I see no overlap or link. Perhaps there is none. That's what Augie would tell me. He's probably right, but of course, accepting that possible reality gets me nowhere. I see the Westbridge Memorial Library up ahead now. And that sparks an idea. The front facade is that kind of red school brick that dates back 100 years. The rest of the building is modern and sleek. I still love libraries. I love the hybrid quality, the new computer sections, and the books yellowing with age. Libraries for me have always had a cathedral-like ambiance, a hushed sanctuary where learning is revered, where we the people elevate books and education to the level of the religious. When we were kids, Dad would take us here on Saturday mornings. He would leave us in the children, young adult section with strict instructions not to misbehave. I would browse through dozens of books. You would grab one, usually one meant for an older reader, sit in a beanbag chair in the corner, and read the entire book. I head down 2 levels to the dingy basement area. It is old school down here, rows and rows of books upon books, most no longer of interest to the casual library visitor, sit on aluminum shelves. There are a few cubby desks for true homework grinders. In the corner, I find the old room. The plaque next to it reads Town History. I lean my head in and rap on the wood. As Dr. Jeff Kaufman looks up at me, his reading glasses drop off his nose. The glasses are on a chain, so they bounce against his chest. He's wearing a thick-knit cardigan sweater buttoned up to the sternum. He's bald on top with shocks of gray hair on the sides that look as if they're trying to flee from his scalp. "Hey, Nap!" "Hey, Dr. Kaufman." He frowns. Dr. Kaufman was a librarian and town historian long before we moved to Westbridge. And when you call someone of authority doctor or even mister as a kid, it is hard to convert to a casual use of their first name as an adult. I move into the cluttered room and ask Dr. Kaufman what he can tell me about the old Nike missile base located by the middle school. Kaufman's eyes light up. He takes a moment or two to gather his thoughts, then he invites me to have a seat across the table from him. The table is a mess of black and white photographs from days of yore. I scan them, hoping to see one of the old base. I don't. He clears his throat and dives in. The Nike missile bases were constructed in the mid-50s throughout northern New Jersey. This was during the height of the Cold War. Back then, we would run school drills where kids would duck under their desks in case of nuclear attack, if you can believe it. Like that would help. The base here in Westbridge was constructed in 1954. The Army just stuck these bases right in the middle of suburban towns? Sure, why not? Farmland, too. New Jersey used to have a lot of farms back then. And what were the Nike missiles used for, exactly, I ask. They were surface-to-air. Put simply, the missiles were an air defense designed to shoot down attacking Soviet aircrafts, most notably their Tu-95, which could fly 6,000 miles without needing to refuel. The missile batteries were in approximately a dozen sites in northern New Jersey. Sandy Hook still has remnants, if you want to visit. The one in Livingston is now an art colony, of all things. There were missile batteries in Franklin Lakes, East Hanover, Morristown. It is hard to believe. Nike missiles in all these towns? Sure. They started with the smaller Nike Ajax missiles, but those were still 30 feet long. They kept them in underground launch sites and would bring them to the surface the same way a body shop would lift a car up in a garage. I don't get it, I say. How could the government keep something like this a secret? They didn't, Kaufman says. At least not at first. He stops now, leans back, and folds his hands over his belly. In fact, the bases were celebrated. When I was 7, that would have been in 1960, my Cub Scout pack got a tour of the facility, if you can believe it. The idea that your friendly local missile site was keeping you safe from the long-range aircraft of the Soviet Union was supposed to make you sleep better. But that changed, I ask. Yes. When? Early 60s. Jeff Kaufman sighs and rises to his feet. He opens a tall file cabinet behind him. See, they replaced the Nike Ajax missiles with the larger Nike Hercules. He plucked out 2 photographs of a scary-ass-looking white missile marked U.S. Army on the side. 41 feet tall, traveled at Mach 3. It's about
2,300 miles per hour, range of 75 miles.
He moved back to the seat, sat, and put his hands on the table in front of him.
But the big change with the Nike Hercules, the reason they clammed up about the program, had to do with the payload.
Meaning?
The missiles were armed with W-31 nuclear warheads.
It is hard to fathom.
There were nuclear weapons right here, yes. Armed warheads. There were even reports of a few near misses. One slid off a dolly when they were moving it higher up a hill, landed on the concrete, and the warhead cracked. Smoke started pouring out. No one knew about it at the time, of course. Everything was kept hush-hush, anyway.
The Nike program ran until the early 1970s. The control center in Westbridge was one of the last to close. That would have been 1974.
And then what, I ask? I mean, what happened to the land after they closed?
And there wasn't much interest in anything military in the 70s. Vietnam was ending, so they just sat there. Most fell into disrepair. Eventually, most were sold off. A condo development was built over a missile battery in East Hanover, for example. One of the roads is called Nike Drive.
What about the base in Westbridge?
Jeff Kaufman smiles at me.
What happened to our base, he says, is a tad murkier.
I wait. He leans toward me and asks what I'm surprised he hadn't asked earlier.
Do you mind me asking why you're suddenly interested in all of this?
I was gonna make something up or tell him that I'd rather not, but then I figure, what's the harm?
It involves a case I'm working on.
What kind of case, if you don't mind me asking?
A long shot, I say. Something from years ago.
Jeff Kaufman meets my eyes.
Are you talking about your brother's death?
Kapow. I don't say anything. In part because I've learned to stay silent and let others jump in to break it. In part because I don't think I can.
Your father and I were friends, he says. You knew that, right?
I manage to nod.
And Leo... Kaufman shakes his head and sits back. His face has lost a bit of color.
He wanted to know about the history of the base, too.
Leo came to you, I ask?
Yes.
When?
I can't say exactly. A few times, probably, within a year of his death. Leo was fascinated by the base. Some of his friends came with him, too.
Do you remember their names?
No, sorry.
What did you tell them?
He shrugs.
The same things I'm telling you now.
My mind is whirring. I feel lost yet again.
At Leo's memorial service, I shook your hand. I doubt you'd remember. So many people were there, and you looked so shell-shocked. I told your dad.
That startles me back. Told my dad what?
That Leo used to come here and ask about the base.
You told my dad?
Sure.
What did he say?
He seemed grateful. Leo was so bright and inquisitive. I thought that your father would want to hear that, that's all. I never thought his death could be connected. I mean, I still don't. Except now you're here too, Nap. And you're no fool either.
He looks up.
So tell me, is there a connection?
Rather than answer him, I say, I need to know the rest of the story.
Okay.
What happened to the Westbridge base after the Nike program closed down?
Officially? It was taken over by the Department of Agriculture.
And unofficially?
When you were a kid, did you ever go up there?
Yes.
We did in my day, too. We used to sneak in through a hole in the fence. I remember one time we got so trashed, one of the soldiers took us home in an army jeep. My dad grounded me for 3 weeks.
The memory brings a small smile to his face.
How close did you get to the base?
Not very.
Exactly.
I'm not following.
Security was tighter for the Department of Agriculture than a nuclear missile control center.
Kaufman tilted his head.
Why do you think that was?
I don't answer.
Think about it. You have these empty military bases. Security apparatus is already in place. If you were a government agency that wanted to fly under the radar, do something clandestine. Look, think of some three-letter government agencies that might like to hide in plain sight like that. It wouldn't be the first time. The old Montauk Air Force Station had dozens of rumors swirling around it.
What kind of rumors?
Nazi scientists, mind control, LSD experiments, UFOs, all kinds of crazy nonsense.
And you believe those? You believe the United States government hid Nazis and aliens in Westbridge?
Oh, for crying out loud, Knapp. They hid nuclear weapons here.
There was a glint in Dr. Kaufman's eyes now.
Is it really such a stretch to think they hid something else?
I say nothing.
It doesn't have to be Nazis and aliens. They could have been testing some advanced technology. DARPA, lasers, drones, weather modification, internet hacking. Does that really seem so far-fetched with all the security around the place?
No, it doesn't. Jeff Kaufman stands now, starts pacing.
I'm a damn good researcher, he says. Back in the day, I dug into this pretty deeply. I even took a trip down to Washington, D.C. to check records and archives. All I found going on there were innocuous corn and livestock studies.
You told all this to my brother?
Him and his friends, yeah.
How many of them?
What?
How many kids came with Leo?
5, maybe 6, I don't remember.
Boys, girls?
He thought about it. I think there were 2 girls, but I can't swear to it. Might have been just 1.
You know that Leo didn't die alone.
He nods. Of course, Diana Stiles was with him, the captain's daughter.
Was Diana one of those girls who visited you with my brother?
No.
I am not sure what to make of that, if anything. Is there anything else you can think of that could help me?
Help you what, Knapp?
Let's say you're right. Let's say the base was doing something top secret, and let's say somehow these kids found out about it. What would happen to them? Now it was his turn to not reply. His mouth just drops open. What else did you learn, Dr. Kaufman?
Just 2 more things.
He clears his throat and sits back down. I found the name of one of the commanders, Andy Reeves. He was supposedly an agriculture expert out of Michigan State. But when I looked into his background, let's just say it was muddled.
CIA?
He fits the pattern, and he still lives in the area.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
I tried, and?
He just said the base did boring agriculture stuff, counting cows and crops. That's how he put it.
What's the second thing?
The closing of the base.
Right. When was that?
15 years ago, Kaufman says. 3 months after your brother and Augie's daughter were found dead.
As I head back toward my car, I call Augie. I just talked to Jeff Kaufman. I think I hear a sigh.
Oh, great.
He had some interesting stuff to say about the old base.
I bet he did.
Do you know Andy Reeves?
I did.
I'm cutting across town now.
How? I've been head of this police department for almost 30 years, remember? He was running the base when it was doing agriculture studies.
I pass a new place that only sells various chicken wings. The smell is enough to harden my arteries.
Did you buy that, I ask? Buy what?
That they were doing agricultural studies.
I buy that, Augie says, a lot more than I buy those mind control rumors as police chief. I knew all the commanders at the base. My predecessor knew all the ones from before that.
Kaufman says back in the day the base used to control nuclear missiles.
And that's what I heard, too.
And then he said when it changed hands, the base became even more guarded and more secretive.
No offense to Kaufman, but he's being overly dramatic.
How so?
The Nike bases were out in the open at first. Kaufman told you that, right?
Right.
So when they went nuclear, it would have been suspicious to all of a sudden be hunkering down and acting too secretive. There was a ton of added security when they went nuclear, but it was more subtle.
And when the Nike bases closed down?
There may have been tighter security, but that was just normal updating and technology. A new team comes in, they put up a better fence.
I cross Oak Street, Westbridge's own restaurant row. I walk past, in order, Japanese, Thai, French, Italian, dim sum, and something called California Fusion restaurants. After that, you hit a slew of bank branches. I don't see the point. I never see any customers in bank branches other than to use the ATMs. I'd like to talk to this Andy Reeves, I say to Augie. Can you arrange it? I expect pushback. I don't get it.
Okay, I'll set it up for you.
You're not going to try to stop me?
No, Augie says. You seem to need this.
He hangs up then. As I reach my car, my phone rings. The caller ID tells me it's Ellie. Hey, I say.
We need you at the shelter.
I don't like the tone. What's wrong?
Nothing. Just get here as soon as you can, okay?
Okay. She hangs up. I slip into the car and grab the portable police siren light. I almost never use it, but this seems like a good time. I slap it on the roof and drive fast. I arrive at the shelter in 12 minutes. I hurry walk inside, turn left, and half rush down the hall. Ellie is waiting outside her office door. The expression on her face tells me that this is something big. What? I ask. Ellie doesn't speak, instead choosing to gesture toward the inside of her office. I turn the knob, push the door open, and look inside. There are two women in the room. The one on the left, I don't recognize. The other, it takes me a second to process. She has aged well, better than I would have expected. The 15 years have been a friend to her. I wonder now if those years had been about sobriety and yoga, or at least something along those lines. Anyway, it looks like it. Our eyes meet. I say nothing for a moment, I just stand there. I knew it would come back to you, she says. I flash back to standing across the street from the row houses, the ill-fitted summer dress, the walk-weave as she headed down the street. It's Lynn Wells, Maura's mother. Chapter 16. I don't waste time. Where's Maura? Close the door, the other woman says. Her hair is the color of carrots, with lipstick to match. She's wearing a tailored gray suit with a frilly shirt. I'm not a fashionista, but it looks expensive. And you are? I turn back and reach for the door. Ellie gives me a quick nod as I close it. My name is Bernadette Hamilton. I'm Lynn's friend. I get a sense that they are more than friends, though I don't care in the slightest. My heart is thumping so hard I'm sure they can see it through my shirt. I turn back to Mrs. Wells, all ready to repeat my question more forcefully, when something makes me pull up. Slow down, I tell myself. I've a million questions to ask her, of course, but I also understand that the best interrogations require almost supernatural patience. Mrs. Wells has come to me, not vice versa. She has sought me out. She has even used Ellie as a go-between, so that she didn't have to show up at my home or office or leave a phone trail. That all took effort. The obvious conclusion? She wants something from me. So I should let her talk. I should let her give up something without being asked, stay quiet. That is my normal modus operandi. No reason to change that because it's personal, so I stay calm. Don't ask her questions. Don't prompt her or make demands. Not yet. Take your time. Plan. But one thing, Leo. There is no way Mrs. Wells is leaving this room without telling me where Maura is. I stay standing and wait for her to make the first move. Finally, Mrs. Wells speaks.
The police came to see me.
I say nothing.
They said Maura might be involved in a murder of a police officer.
When I still don't reply, she says, "Is that true?"
I nod.
I see her friend Bernadette reach over and put her hand on Mrs. Wells. "Do you really think Maura could be involved in a murder?" Lynn Wells asks.
"Probably, yeah," I say.
Her eyes widen a bit. I see the hand tighten over hers.
"Maura wouldn't kill anyone. You know that."
I bite back a sarcastic rejoinder and stay silent.
The police officer who visited me, her name was Reynolds, from somewhere in Pennsylvania. She said you were helping in the investigation?
Mrs. Wells says it like a question. Again, I don't take the bait.
I don't understand, Knapp. Why would you be investigating a murder in another state?
Did Lieutenant Reynolds tell you the name of the victim?
I don't think so. She just said it was a police officer.
His name is Rex Canton. I keep an eye on her face. Nothing. Does the name ring a bell?
She considers it. No, I don't think so.
Rex was in our high school class.
At Westridge High?
Yes. The color starts to ebb from her face. The heck with patience. Sometimes you startle them with the surprise question. Where's Maura?
I don't know,
Lynn Wells says. I lift my right eyebrow, offering up my most incredulous expression.
I don't. That's why I came to you,
she looks up at me. I hoped you could help me.
Help you find Mora?
Yes.
My voice is thick. Haven't seen Mora since I was 18 years old.
The phone on the desk started.